Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Today we'd like to send a special thank you to the Danny Meyer Restaurant Group, Union Square Cafe, Gramercy Tavern, Maialino, and Untitled. Show your support at these restaurants by ordering one of the menu items featuring goat. Goat is the most eaten protein in the entire world, yet in the US we import most of our goat. Our dairy farms are forced to kill some male goats at birth because there's no market for them. Help make a change. Support No Goat Left Behind.
Sunday, Burning Down the House on Heritage Radio Network, weekly fix of everything related to design, architecture, and creative arts. I'm Curtis B. Wayne, your host. In this episode, I'm going to talk about emerging voices, the world of competition, the landscape is changing in favor of our younger colleagues. In studio with us are Ryan, Tyler, and Luke. Introduce yourselves.
I'm Ryan Doyle.
I'm Luke Carnahan.
Tyler Kane.
Thank you for joining me. You guys were a team that won a competition, which is a very great thing. And I thank you for leaving your groupies outside. I appreciate that. And just to get things rolling, because it's topical, it wouldn't be so much fun to talk about next week or the week after. As we were just hinting at before we came into the studio, I was very happy to have been invited this last Friday to attend a party in honor of 1 year in New York, held by the Bjarke Ingels Group at the Sterrett Lehigh building, that historic Art Deco industrial loft on the west side in Manhattan, over there at 26th Street and 10th Avenue, just west of the High Line. And it was very interesting, very amazing group of people. A lot of incredibly tall Danish people, men and women. And a really interesting mix of Bjarke Ingels 10,000 BFFs. That man has more close friends than anybody, I think, since possibly Ronald Reagan. It was really very interesting. I met a young fellow, not probably much older than you guys, who works for the Danish Trade Council here in New York, and he wasn't giving out any business cards because he was involved in arranging the social events for the Crown Prince of Denmark, who's in New York this weekend, and the Crown Princess. So it was all sort of hot. He could talk about it, but he couldn't give out any business cards in case some cyber stalker tracked them down or something like that. some Russians, some Greeks, some Americans, not too many Americans. I bumped into Bjarke, and he introduced me to Mark Wigley, who's the dean at Columbia. I was hanging out with Charlie Renfro of DS&R, and they were very happy. They were drinking Dark and Stormies, which is, that's the drink of Bermuda, and it's a very potent beverage. And and they were loving it. And, of course, there was the booming DJ thing going on, and a lot of pretty young architecture students of all genders. And it was, but, you know, and everybody, but everybody was happy. That was what was really great. It was just packed in a space on the 14th floor at the Stair at Lehigh, which is not where BIG's offices are. They have a very modest, maybe 1,100 square foot loft space with a lot of little study models were lined up on the way in. But everyone was very happy. And it wasn't just because there was a lot of beer and dark and stormies and a few sweets. Not a lot of stuff to eat, but a lot to drink. So in some ways, it was a lot like the kind of party that we used to have at the end of a semester in architecture school. Just a lot of libation and a lot of happiness. And so even though there were these throngs of people, it was hard to get through from one part to the next. It was no problem. It was like, excuse me, everybody was just kind of like slithering past. And it was really, it was amazingly happy considering there are that many cutthroat competitors packed into one room. Everything was really happy. I mean, one thing that I wanted to remark on is that the Danes all showed up in some sort of interesting modified formal wear. Bjarke himself was in a black suit with a white shirt and a black tie. The guy from the Danish trade consulate was in a black suit with a black tie and a white shirt. It was just like they dressed up to go to a party like they were going to an American funeral. It was very, very interesting. But it kind of worked, you know. It set a tone. Unlike the Swiss with whom I've worked, they were not wearing white socks with their black suits. But it was really a very interesting cultural experience, especially when I interrupted or insinuated myself into a conversation between the Danish trade guy and a Finnish woman architect. They were speaking to each other in Scandinavian accented English, and I thought, this is very strange. I mean, why are a couple of Danes talking to each other in English? Well, so then I had to find out what the deal was. And, you know, she was Finnish and he was Danish, and so the only thing they had in common was English, which has become the international language, which is a wonderful thing. But I mean, but the world that Bjarke Ingels and his partner, oh, I met David Dahl, who's one of his partners, D-A-H-L-E. Jack, I'll help you with some of the tags later. They've all learned English and are happy to speak English, but they got where they got through competitions, which is the road on which you guys are heading. And I have to say that although they're very happy, it's for sure a wicked, wicked game. So before we get into talking about your own experiences, let's have some Chris Isaacs music, can we?
Play to make me feel this way. good thing to do. Let me dream of you. What a wicked thing to say. You never felt this way. What a wicked thing to do. To make me dream of you. And I wanna fall in love. No, I wanna fall in love with you.
Back with Burning Down the House. Curtis B. Wayne, your host. We're going to talk about the world of competitions. Guys, you just were winners with a scheme for a sort of a, and I hate this word, intervention, but it works, to help clean up the Gowanus Canal. Tell us about the Gowanus. So for those of us who do not live in New York and don't know about that stinking waterway that runs through post-industrial Brooklyn.
Well, you know, I've lived here for almost 5 years now, and I didn't know what the Gowanus Canal was before undergoing this competition, but it's actually an old industrial relic, this barge canal that was created and ultimately fell into disuse like all of the other pieces of the industrial port that Manhattan used to be, and now is one of the most polluted sites in the country.
Where does it run from and to?
It runs about, I think it's about 20 blocks long, and it runs out into...
East River.
Yeah, kind of the East River Bay.
Speak up. Don't
be
shy.
It runs into the East River in Manhattan.
And it just was put on the national priority list of the EPA, making it, again, one of the kind of most decrepit polluted sites in America. So, ripe for attention.
Right, and then this is where politics comes in. The mayor doesn't want it declared a Superfund site, which would bring in federal money to clean it up, because that would do bad things to the real estate values around there.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think a lot of the key developers that were targeted for new projects here were dissuaded for all of the new requirements that would come with it being a Superfund site. So
right.
It's kind of a battle against what should we be doing and what is economically attractive at the time.
So what were your respective roles in this, the three of you? Who, I mean, I'm always interested in about the topic of how collaborative work unfolds.
Happens, yeah. Tyler was definitely the leader of the pack.
Come closer.
Yeah. Tyler was definitely leading the team, kind of helping us to figure out what we should be doing. I definitely was involved much more in the beginning and then at the end, those last crazy couple nights. And I think Luke was holding us through the rest of it. Something like that.
And your scheme was what?
Well, I think when we started...
Let's back up. What was the design commission, or what was the program that was the topic of the competition?
The program required us to have a stance of remediation towards the site. So no matter what you chose to do, it was about... remediation had to be a part of your scheme. And then after that, it was about tying community together. A lot of the popular buzzwords of pedestrian and neighborhood and residents, stuff like that. So the program was pretty open in that you needed to remediate and you needed to reinvigorate a dilapidated community.
Right. And this is around like the backside of Carroll Gardens, right?
I believe so.
Yeah, it's north there. North of Park Slope. Yeah.
Where... a lot of the people drive. They don't walk around over there. Who sponsored this competition?
The competition was sponsored by the Gowanus by Design, which is a nonprofit community organization that really focuses on trying to stimulate development and awareness about the Gowanus Canal community. David Briggs and Anthony Dean were the two heads of that, both architects, local architects, who... oversaw this competition.
So they organized themselves much in a way that the people who eventually prevailed in the preservation and redevelopment of the High Line created their own organization and started a dialogue about what to do about the Gowanus.
Exactly.
With the competition as a vehicle.
Yeah, and then, I mean, the name of the competition was the Gowanus Lowline, so I think immediately they were setting up that comparison.
Sure.
Which I think then, you know, kind of for us became the launching point for our scheme, is how to compare what we wanted to do relative to the Highline.
And so, what did you propose?
I think we thought that, you know, it's not really the same situation as the Highline. It's not... The Highline works as a public space because it's in the middle of Manhattan. You know, there are millions of people coming in and out of that area every day of the year. So it's appropriate to have this, you know, accessible park that, you know, increases the well-being of the people that already live in that community. In this instance, there isn't much of a strong, vibrant community around the Gowanus. So we knew that our scheme had to deal not just with how to remediate the sort of pollution of the canal, but to find a way to reinvigorate that community and make it a place where people live. You know, we didn't want to just do another eco park, which has become a kind of hip thing.
Well, I want to respectfully disagree with you.
Okay.
Because the High Line is way over on the edge of Manhattan. If you're trying to get there by mass transit, good luck. You have to walk quite a distance from the nearest, say, C train stop. There are buses on 9th Avenue or so, but they don't run late at night. Of course, the High Line closes at a certain time. What we see now in development around the High Line has all grown up in step with development of the High Line. Before that, it was tough. I spoke with a steward at Lehigh Building. In 1985, I was in a partnership with a guy, and he met some rich Middle Eastern would-be investor, some, I don't know, Kuwaiti prince or something, who had in mind buying the Sterrett Lehigh Building because it was half empty. It was being offered for $6 million. And he had some contacts with people at American Express and with a construction company that was affiliated with American Express, and they wanted to develop it in some way. The question was, to what end? It was post-industrial space. There was no more manufacturing happening in Manhattan in that area, certainly not on a large scale. It was a building built for manufacturing, which is why the High Line runs past it and near to it. But it was a pretty much huge, useless building. Now, 25, 26 years later, that building just sold for $1 billion. And I'm sure it's been through several different changes of hands during that period, but the High Line made it possible to think of having people living, or certainly wanting to go over into that part of Manhattan that was disused and not wanted. So I think there's some real genius in the notion of getting people to think about that part of the Gowanus Canal. Because, you know, when the sewage is not flowing through the canal, it's a sort of interesting little corner of town over there. Once in a while, you'll see some watercraft going past. The scale is very low on either side of the canal. I did some work at Monty's Venetian Room on Carroll Street, which is closed, and I think it's going to reopen just about two blocks from the canal. And it's almost like being in a European sort of, you know, almost like outer parts of Amsterdam over there, having that canal. But there, the problems of cleaning up the canal, which is polluted from all of the residue of the plants that took coal and turned it into coal gas, which then went into the piping system to provide illuminating gas and then later heating for the greater New York metropolitan area, is a real problem of, you know, vast scale. So, but tell us what your scheme was for how to get the canal to, as I understand it, naturally rejuvenate itself.
Well, I think our strongest point was that we imagined that a lot of people would be going into this problem, as Ryan said, just designing a landscape solution, just kind of a park. So it would not be development intensive, but taking natural remediative processes and making a lot of tidal basins and a lot of wetlands and all this other kind of stuff. And we said that our team decided that this had to be a contributing piece to the urban fabric, not to mention that Prospect Park is only like a stone's throw away. We don't need another hole that's covered with green. And so our solution was kind of a two-part solution. One did have this a series of tiered wetlands components that allowed for the natural remediative processes, a series of microclimates that stepped down from, you know, all the way from a few blocks away down to the water's edge. And that over time, not only stormwater, but the things that were already in the soil would be pulled out by each of these different kind of slivers mm-hmm. of wetlands ecosystems. And then paired with that was how could we create a new kind of streetscape that existed within a wetlands environment. Yeah. And so we had a series of elevated pathways and walkways, steel grating that allowed for access to peeling up some of these strips of wetlands and sticking program underneath them.
Right, but they'd be constructed wetlands.
Correct.
Yeah, yeah. So those of you who are loyal listeners can scroll back and look at the conversation we had with Skip Backus from the Omega Institute, where they have the Institute for Sustainable Living, which has artificially constructed wetlands, just like what you're describing, only they put it inside a greenhouse.
Absolutely.
But what apparently will keep any of this from actually being done is, to a greater or lesser extent, politics. Mm-hmm. Let's, Jack, take another musical break. Down the house with a little cynical music about politics from Cream. I'm Curtis B. Wayne, here with Ryan, Tyler, and Luke, who have embarked together on the road of doing competitions to get themselves known. By the way, so you won this competition. What kind of cool swag did you get?
Well, you know, we got a kind of a complimentary honorarium, as it were, and we're invited. Come on,
details. Big bucks, right? Like the Pritzker, right? You all got bronze medals and a couple million each.
A nice fancy gallery opening in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm.
That's nice.
Yeah.
That was nice.
Yeah.
It's still open, I think, right?
I think it is.
Yeah. I believe so.
Where?
It is at the SET, S-E-T, Gallery. Actually on Carroll Street, I believe, in Brooklyn.
Okay. Open through when, do you think?
I think it's through the end of this month.
Mm-hmm. Which is October 2011.
Yes.
Yes. Okay, that's good.
There was some talk on the down low about them trying to get our exhibition into the Center for Architecture, which was kind of unconfirmed, but would be also great.
That is the New York chapter of the American Institute of Architects Center for Architecture in LaGuardia Place. Mm-hmm. I don't know why it would be so difficult to get in there. All they had to do is, I suppose, ask. You know, call up Rick Bell, the executive director, and say, hey, you got some stuff we want to hang. Actually, any of you could do that. So what did you learn from this experience? I mean, I know I've done competitions, and I did a couple, and at the end, then I was convinced that it was a waste of time. Do you think you're going to continue to want to compete?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think at first none of us could believe it, for sure. And I know I can.
Well, the graphics were really compelling. I mean, you know, you really did a good job explaining and developing your idea to where it seemed absolutely the right thing to do, which is always a good indication of something that's well thought out. It seems inevitable that that's what should be done. Mm-hmm. And I enjoyed looking at your graphics.
Yeah, thank you. I think that was the strong part of our project, that it was very clear and easy to understand. I think, you know, the challenge is to identify what the sort of intent of the competition is. And in this case, it's just to have a dialogue and to facilitate conversations about what to do with the Gowanus Canal. So it was important for us to be very clear about these main two components that we thought would make a vibrant community in this neighborhood.
That's a pregnant pause. Do we need another music break so you guys can think of more stuff to talk about? Come on, I know you got stuff to talk about. Do I have to go back talking about enormously tall and friendly Danes in their black suits?
So why is it that you think the competitions were a waste of time?
Well, I'll give you, I like case studies, and I, like our friend Rick Cook, believe in this, in the power of narrative. I was 27 years old, and I was a designer. I was almost licensed. I was living in Chicago. And the Graham Foundation, which has a really nice prairie-style house in the what they call the Gold Coast there, the more Brooklyn sort of part of the coastal area of Chicago, not too far from the main shopping district, you know, where Water Tower Place is in Chicago, just a little bit up the road there, along Lakeshore Drive. So that's where the Graham Foundation's headquarters is. And they had invited seven architects to design what they thought would be like a prototypical, looking forward, throw out some crazy ideas, townhouses for a prototypical street in Chicago. And it was seven because everybody at that point still remembered the riots of 1968, where there were the Chicago Seven, you know, yippies who'd been indicted and tried for rioting. And that was a total political circus, and I think that they were hoping for some architectural circus to happen. And these, each of them was rather more or less iconic. You know, it was each guy doing his own stuff. There was something by Helmut Jahn, who it's kind of faded from our awareness, but he was super hot at that time. Stanley Tigerman did something that was kind of postmodern and pop and funny, and Larry Booth did something, and Tom Beebe did something. All these guys who then later went on to be heads of architecture schools and stuff like that, which is what happens. If you stick around long enough and that's what you really want to do, you can do it. And so then there was a follow-up. It was open to everybody. Design your prototypical Chicago townhouse to complete the block, you know, face off against them. And to me, it seemed like that was just a beauty pageant. Mm-hmm. And I really didn't see a lot of ideas that had anything to do with either A, Chicago, or B, the problems of having a townhouse in Chicago, where in Chicago you have to have a car. So I designed a house, and its front facade literally stuck its tongue out at the neighbors. It had a ramped driveway that was rendered in pink concrete, and it had a curved edge at the end, and it had one big eye with glass block. Now, vernacular house construction post-war in Chicago, post-World War II, had an almost iconographic glass block square window in the front where the powder room was. And if you see these houses and you see the glass block, you know that, oh, they have a powder room just inside, just adjacent to the living room. How wonderful is that? Hmm. So, of course, I had to include that. The backside of the townhouse, because in Chicago we have backyards and then we have garages and then there's an alley, the backside was rendered as a sort of a neo-traditional version of a prairie house with horizontality and a hipped roof, because it seemed to me that all these guys had turned their backs on the prairie school heritage of Chicago in favor of the Mesian heritage of Chicago, which was, 50 years later. To my mind, Mies is no more important than Wright and Griffin and Burley and all those guys working around 1900. And perhaps even because we were at the very beginning of the postmodern mindset, maybe even more important. Maybe there was something we could learn from all that and make some real architecture somehow. But what I didn't do is I drew this up beautifully. I spent hours at night, late into the night. It was the best draftsmanship I have ever done. ink on Strathmore with Prismacolor. And in the end, they didn't even let me hang my stuff because James Ingo Fried was offended. He was on the jury. He told Tigerman, this is disgraceful. Well, Tigerman got my social commentary. Fried was just too, frozen or crippled to understand what I was trying to express in terms of a dialogue with the other stuff that had already come before in this first part of the competition. And I thought, well, fuck it. Why should I do that? And I took my plates to Tigerman. I just went over to see him. Do you know about Stanley? You should read about Stanley Tigerman. He's really a social activist, and I hope before he's dead one of these weeks, I'll have to get him to come and be a call-in guest. Because Stanley feels that if we as architects don't pick up the ball and do the right thing politically or socially, or in terms of sustainability, or in terms of integrating the whole thing together, who else is going to do it?
Absolutely.
And, I went to see Stanley. I'd met Stanley a couple times before that. And I said, Stanley, this is a good project. It's got this, it's got this. I was really kind of pumped. He patted me on the arm. Stanley's about this tall, and he's a real nice guy. He wears the round glasses, you know. He's smart, though. He said, you don't have to win. You did a good project. Other jurors knew that you did a good project. You've got a good project. You don't have to be on the cover of Architectural Record. You could be in the back. You don't have to be published at all. You did good work. You learned something from it. Just, you know. And then he said, you know, you guys who, I say I was from Chicago. You guys who go, you know, from Chicago, you go to New York, you hang out with Eisenman, you get big ideas, you come back here. You know, we should never let you come back. A couple of years later, we came back to New York. And here I am.
Well, I think that's really the... I think what you said is key to making sure competitions aren't a waste of time. Because if all you're doing is playing to win, then if you don't win...
Now, I was doing it for the dialogue. I at least expected to get my drawings hung. Mm-hmm. I mean, Rich Taransky, who I knew from college, his submission was a hand drawing, which was fine, of a man sitting in a rocking chair smoking his pipe. That was his solution for a townhouse. Mm-hmm. And he got hung. Well, I was like, you know, it was, yeah, this is not good in my mind. Mm-hmm. But what I didn't do is I didn't explain the ideas in any of the drawings. I just let the drawings be the drawings. I didn't have any text to describe the ideas that I had. So, I mean, we've come a long way since those early days of an architectural submission just being the drawings. Now it's moved towards its images and its thoughts.
It's all about
you got to explain what you're showing, and that's something that I didn't understand because I came out of the sort of the high art world of John Q. Haydick, and you know, very mysterious drawings and no explanation whatsoever. So I've learned things since then. Well, now I've learned that the whole thing, you know, really matters. Jack, could we have another break of about 3 minutes, and we'll come back and talk about the future for you guys and your competitions. Thank you.
My own thing.
Burning Down the House on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm Curtis B. Wayne. We're talking about the whole thing of putting your ideas out, being a young graduate architect, moving into the profession, getting yourself known, and having some fun along the way. So my guests here have just won an enormously, possibly interesting competition for ideas of how to clean up one of New York's major cesspools. So what's next, guys? What next is interesting you?
Well, we did have our eye on another competition that's actually coming up, sponsored by the Emerging Young Architects of New York, the ENYA.
Oh, yes, through the Center for Architecture.
Yes.
Right. Yes.
And they have their sites on an old transportation depot up on the Upper West Side, very near to the kind of eco park that exists up, I think it's above 125th Street. And they're proposing, how can we redo this? A similar piece of old infrastructure, dilapidated, now unused. How can we remake it into something that's, again, contributing to the city?
So where it's above 125th Street.
The Harlem Edge.
Yeah. Oh, that's had a couple different things. There's a bit of promenade along the river there.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Our friend Professor Knox from Cooper Union, Rod Knox, did a pavilion there about 20 years ago that was covered over as a temporary exhibition or dance space. It was covered with a fabric called glamé. And over time, of course, the wind just ripped that to tatters and the city took it down. But for a while, it was sparkling and interesting and attractive. It's above and west of Dinosaur Barbecue.
There you go.
Yeah, fairly close.
Sure. And there are all those empty warehouse-like spaces up there.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'd say I'd go with the Dinosaur Barbecue theme and turn it into exactly, Barbecue exactly. Center.
Well, we're all Q's guys, so we've been to the original.
And where's that?
In Syracuse.
Syracuse, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The first Dinosaur Barbecue. The only real Dinosaur Barbecue.
Who knew? Who knew that it was a chain?
Yeah, there's only a couple of them, I believe.
I think they have two or three.
Cool. All right. Well, yeah, good luck with that. It all depends on who the jury is, I suppose.
Yeah, and again, like I was saying before, I think it, for better or worse, the trick with these is to figure out what they're asking. It's almost like taking a test in that sense, that you need to figure out how to answer the right questions correctly, not necessarily know all of the material. You know what I mean?
No.
Okay. Well, that's sad. No.
Not know all the material. You mean fake it?
No, not fake it. I mean, maybe that's just been my own conflict with this process. You know, kind of in discussion about your story there. You know, I think that's been the other side of the coin. You know, in this case,
to this day, I have no idea what the Graham Foundation was, you know, trying to elicit in terms of some sort of dialogue. I can guarantee, however, there was no dialogue that came out of that successor competition that I entered.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a bunch of pictures that got hung up, and everybody said, ah.
Right. Look at these nice things.
Yeah. Oh, look. Well, that's interesting. Here's a guy smoking a pipe. Hmm.
Right. And I think that's been the difficult thing for us as young practitioners is to decide, you know, to what extent do we participate in those things that are focused on images and conversation, and then to what extent do we get involved with, you know, and do a project like you've done, had done, where you actually learned something yourself and really designed it and got knee-deep in the architecture of it.
When I look back at it, I was kind of like a little bit ahead of myself. There was so much stuff in what I had drawn, and there was so much inside joke that, you know, I just couldn't resist doing. Like, okay, so it's a house, so see, I grew up in a musical family, so therefore there should be a piano. So if it's a piano, it's probably a baby grand because it's not that big a house. So we're going to put a baby grand on the mezzanine, and we're going to put a piano curve around the piano. Ha ha, isn't that funny? The only reason you should have a piano curve, I think, unless you're channeling Corbu. And I thought that was just hilarious, but others had other ideas. Mm-hmm. So the Enya thing. Well, I guess you got to just, you know... See, my feeling is if you're going to do a competition, don't put too much effort into it because it's unpaid.
Yeah, well, just, I'll tell you that my biggest issue with this one is the fee. They want... I think this is the only one I've seen that they scale up the fee with the number of people that are involved. There's a price, you know, for a single individual is like $50 or $70 or something like that. If two or three people are doing it, it's like $100 and something, and it goes up from there if you add more people to the team. It's kind of a frustrating thing to think.
It's funny that they think that we should be on the honor system.
Yeah.
So if there are prize monies, then if you're all on your own, do you get like $50 prize? But if there are 10 of you, you get $500?
I don't think so, unfortunately.
You know, that, I mean, that's, yeah, I mean, that's kind of like, that's a very interesting social construct.
Yeah, well, and that's been my beef with the, most of the architecture lectures in the city cost money.
Yeah.
In particular, the ones run at the Center for Architecture.
Yeah, I know.
That's, and again, you know, we're very thankful to be here on a program that is trying to communicate.
And we're
to
free.
Exactly. Communicate for free to
that's
more people.
That's right. I don't get paid. Jack gets paid a little bit. You know, he gets beer money. Right. It's practically free.
It's like we have enough. We have a hard enough time getting regular people to understand
what we do. I mean, either the mission statement of an organization is to get the word out and try to raise the level of discourse, or it's just a friggin' old AIA limping along trying to make $100 on 10, you know, pitiful souls who had nothing better to do on a Tuesday night than to show up and hear somebody go on and.
Yeah.
Because most architects don't know how to talk. Ever heard Tom Main talk?
I actually have heard Tom Main talk.
Did you like it?
I heard him talk at Greenbelt. I actually thought he gave a great lecture.
Did he?
Yeah, it was very impressive.
Because when I heard him talk, he was just kind of mumbling, and those are some of my early drawings, and I like them, and I thought I'd show them to you. It wasn't working for me.
Maybe you saw him on a bad day, or I saw him on a great day, because
let's subscribe to both.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well. Yeah. They should be free. Kick it up a notch. Cooper Union, which was founded by Peter Cooper for free education for the working classes, mm-hmm. charges to go to lectures there.
Yep.
That is so wrong.
Yep.
That is so wrong. I'm allowed to say that. I'm a Cooper grad. You know, I have contributed to them. Not recently, not since they put up a few different projects with which I have substantial disagreements. But...
One by Tom Main.
Yeah.
No, on a more basic level, they ripped out the 1910 cast iron and bent wood cherry seats, threw them away, flipped them to a salvage company, and put in upholstered chairs which have a estimated life of maybe 20 years. So they threw away 100-year-old chairs that could have been fixed over again, that had already worked for 100 years, in favor of ones that were upholstered and a little bit wider for the wider American butt. Well, you know, I don't know why they... someone must have given them, I don't know, a couple hundred thousand, saying, we want to endow some nice, comfortable chairs. Well, that seemed like a real waste of opportunity, given the original mission statement, which the trustees, I believe, have not been carrying out, which is to provide free education to all who would wish to apply.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a Cooper problem, mm-hmm. you know. So how do you feel about the state of things in New York? You're all working, I guess. You all have jobs. Mm-hmm. Thank God for that. Here in the middle of the second Great Depression. I think we might be coming out of it. It's hard to tell. A lot of our brothers and sisters have been severely underemployed or unemployed, and I think in some ways it has made us all a lot more serious about our implied social contract between us as the creators of form and society at large, which then appeals to me in the context of the OWS movement, where there are self-nominated protest kids and some not kids who just simply want to call bullshit on the received status quo, which is growing to occupy corporate food. We heard about that today, right, Jack? Yes? Oh, Jack doesn't have a mic. But yes, here on Heritage Radio Network, we've been talking about all of these things being all interconnected. And they are all interconnected. How we make our buildings is all of a piece with where the materials come from. How do you get to where you're going to work? What kind of food are you going to eat? How good is the quality of your water? Which is why the Gowanus Project is really important. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, we live in an aquasphere. I mean, you know, the world cannot get on without clean water. And water, I mean, everybody knows that we're coming to a crisis with oil. That's yesterday's problem. Tomorrow's problem is clean water. What do we do as architects to diminish the use of water? I mean, that we use potable water to fill cooling towers to keep office buildings cooled in the summer when we could use recycled water, just for example.
Well, you know, one of the things that interested me, coming from a firm that has such a dedication to sustainability holistically and including that water conservation, is that when you actually look
at... Where do you work?
Well, I used to work at Cook Plus Fox. I work now at a...
Yeah, I heard of them.
At a small firm called LeBron O'Sullivan Architects.
Uh-huh.
But when you look at our nation's use of water, 31% of the water that we use goes to irrigation, and 49% goes to thermoelectric cooling. So that's 80% of our water use. If we're really serious about stemming where the water goes and what we use it for, it's actually not in buildings. Like, I think all of the residential buildings in the country use 1% of the water that we consume as a nation. So,
you mean taking baths, washing our hands, flushing a toilet?
All of it.
Is 1%?
1% is residential.
You better check that stat.
I'm pretty sure.
You have to come back and defend that.
I'm pretty sure that is correct. And I think even if you include all commercial and municipal use, it jumps up to maybe 14%. So,
yeah, well, there was that, what was it, 45% for thermoelectric cooling?
49%.
So 50% of water use is in cooling towers.
That's correct. And a lot of it in basically power plants.
Well, that's part of the built environment. So that's a huge thing that we could do. I mean, forget the waterless urinals for a moment. What about cooling that didn't require a cooling tower? How about buildings that worked with... natural flow of wind and we're self-shading so that they didn't get hot.
Absolutely.
And we're highly insulated in a sensible way so that they didn't get too cold in the winter. This is entirely within our control. This is Stanley's agenda. This is my agenda. Who's going to do it if we don't?
Agreed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which makes it, I mean, maybe we should start our own competition. A net zero skyscraper for we don't need another skyscraper in Midtown.
Say, you know? We don't need any more.
Yeah. No, I mean, that gets to the a previous rant of mine, which is why didn't Jean Nouvel, who doesn't need the money, turn down the commission from the Heinz companies to design the Tower of Glass next to MoMA? It's a tower that doesn't belong there in terms of urban design propositions. It's too big. There's no mass transit that serves the site directly. It's already on a congested street. it's never mind that Amanda Burden at City Planning gave it a pass. From my point of view, and I think many others, it's a city planning disaster. I think by rights he should have turned it down and said, no, it's the wrong project for that site. Instead, he just let his towering ego get going. He collected the fee. I can't believe that he really needed that fee that much.
Well, what was it, Philip Johnson or something like that, with the famous quote that we are whores?
No, he said, I'm just a whore.
I'm just a whore. Yeah, well, I mean, particularly in New York City, it's difficult to argue why we need to build another new building in the first place.
Right.
Right?
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Let's take about 30 seconds of Blue Rondo, Jack, and come back. Burning Down the House on Heritage Radio Network. Well, you guys are like the wave of the present becoming the future. When are you all going to get licensed?
Next May, June.
Come on.
Hopefully within 2 years.
Sometime soon. I think I'm halfway done.
I'm going to beat
good.
All these
That's
guys
good.
Then. Yeah.
That's good. I've talked a lot. You guys have talked a little bit. I mean, how do you feel about Tigerman's proposition that if we don't do these things, no one's going to?
Well, I think that's the truth of the situation. I mean, that's part of the whole sustainable design movement.
Do you think we do it out of obligation, implied or otherwise, or do you think that we're going to be forced to have to rise to the challenge because no one is doing it?
I think that's part of it, but I think it becomes part of a greater responsibility as a designer just because of the awareness that has been brought up in the past decade.
Right. Awareness is way up. Way up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, then, you know, I think our role has, at least lately, for better or worse, been to visualize our reaction to that awareness. You know, which kind of ties back into the reason for doing a competition and the reason for this competition existing in the first place is our, you know, ability to spatialize in terms that regular people can understand what a possible solution might be to the problems that we encounter.
So you see us as integrators who can take a vision and raise the level of common discourse.
Hopefully.
I know I'm putting words in your mouth.
Yes.
I'm good at doing that.
I mean, personally, I have the belief that, especially when it comes to sustainability, that the biggest problem is actually not apathy, contrary to perhaps what many people would believe, but it's more a case of ignorance. And I think that architects, especially those of us who have had experience being surrounded by environments that are learned in what sustainability means and what it entails, we kind of take for granted the level of discourse that we can have. And when you go talk to someone who lives out in the middle of nowhere and try to expect that they know why this is important or what it comprises or why we have to change, I think you make a huge jump that they can't possibly keep up with.
And so we just have to keep at explaining why it is that we... well, we're not saying they have to do it, but because as an architect, we can't say do it my way anymore. We really have to strongly suggest that if they could, would they consider to do something in a different way? They, our clients, they, the public, they, the politicians.
I think education is key.
Yeah. We become advocates and educators.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Or champions. I think it's time for us to go out on that. Let us be the champions of the world. This is Burning Down the House. I'm Curtis B. Wayne. Thank you for listening. Keep the faith.
Time after time, I've done my sentence, but committed no crime. And bad mistakes, I've made a few. I've had my shells and kicks in my
listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.